Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the secret societies when we come back. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, which was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. Benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush said that what Americans wanted was jobs, jobs, jobs. But you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution. They wrote our Bill of Rights and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It is not measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money, the wealth, is in private business. It's in sales. It's not in public business, and it's certainly not in jobs, jobs, jobs. That's why I contend that it's time that you and I cash in on our inheritance and learn how to collect those benefits of that old covenant contract. And to collect those benefits in real wealth, things like gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil, that's real property instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you want to learn more about how to do just that, why don't you call for information on our CD Homeschool for Adults? That's our business school. And while you're at it, why don't you get our free general law CD package at the same time? Doesn't cost you anything. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's informative, and it's entertaining, it's educational, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, if you're online, you can go to our webpage, georgegordon.org, and then go to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there off our archives page, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, last time we started with the King James Bible and the secret societies. There is a movement afoot to rewrite the Bible. And as I pointed out to you last time, there is a warning, a copyright warning in the Bible written by the author himself, the creator of the universe, and he said, don't you do that. And if you do that, here's what I'm going to do to you. You'll read that in Revelation 22, verse 18. And he said, now, I don't want you to add to this, and I don't want you to take anything away from it. But there's a group of people out there that have already done that. It isn't something that they're going to do in the future. They have already done it past tense. It's already an accomplished fact. So who are these people who have rewritten the Bible for us to pervert, to keep from us the message that our Creator wanted us to know? Well, it might be asked why, with so many other good Bibles available at the time of Martin Luther, did King James commission another Bible to be written that most Christian fundamentalists prescribed to this very day? Well, if you study history, you will learn that King James was not only the King of Scotland, but he was also, simultaneously, the King of England. His royalty helped to unite England and Scotland against France, Italy, and according to many authors, the Vatican itself. So how was it then that King James VI of Scotland, and the same fellow who was later crowned King James I of England, came to this high level of authority in both England and Scotland and did it simultaneously? Well, the answer lies in the Knights Templar. The Knights Templar is a secret society believed to have formed during the early 12th century. The Knights had sought refuge in Scotland, which was largely controlled by their allies, the Freemasons. Templar history is both fascinating and controversial. In the Hiram Key, Masonic Order members Christopher Knight and Robert Lomas reviewed the development of modern Freemasonry and its impact on the world. And their text provided far more insight than many other books intended to promote Freemasonry as an entirely benign and largely humanitarian spiritual fraternity. According to Knight and Lomas, from the completion of Roslyn Chapel in southern Scotland back in 1486, to the official opening of the Grand Lodge of England on the 24th of June, 1717, the Freemasons evolved from the Templar Order, and for reasons of self-preservation, the organization remained hidden from general view until the power of the Vatican began to slide rapidly in the 16th century. This slide in Roman Catholic Church authority, more commonly called the Reformation, began on October the 31st, the day that we now celebrate as Halloween. Back in 1517, that was when Martin Luther, a professor at the University of Wittenberg with suspicious ties to the German Rosicrucian order, issued 95 theses considered heretical to the Pope and the Catholic Church. Luther, generally considered as being anti-Semitic and sexist, but otherwise supportive to Jesus, wrote three famous treatises described in 1520. It was an open letter to the Christian nobility of the German nation governing the reform of the Christian estate and the Babylonian captivity of the church on the freedom of a Christian. These works won Luther tremendous popular support, as they strongly professed Luther's conviction that forgiveness of sins and human salvation was God's free gift of grace extended to everyone. It was a position that left the Catholic Church out of the divine pecking order. This enraged the Pope, and the Pope subsequently directed Luther's excommunication from the Catholic Church in 1521. Well, soon after that, King Henry VIII began to have some marital problems with his first wife. She was Catherine of Aragon, and he sought resolution from the Catholic Church. Well, the Pope refused. Well, thus began England's separation from the Catholic Church. In 1533, Thomas Cromwell, King Henry's chief minister, ushered the Act in Restraint of Appeals through Parliament. Likewise, the following year, he passed the Act of Supremacy, which authorized full control of the church by the king. To facilitate this jihad, the Archbishop of Canterbury, a guy by the name of Thomas Cranmer, authorized the first English translation of the Bible. So, the Church of England usurped the power of the Roman Catholic Church, at least for a time, though not without contest. One brief reversal occurred during the reign of Henry VIII's daughter, Queen Mary I, also known as Bloody Mary. Partly because her royalty was feigned by Henry. Once in power, the Queen began to restore Catholicism, earning her the epithet Bloody Mary for her role in executing hundreds of Protestants. In 1554, she married King Philip II of Spain, the son of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, recalled the authors of the Hiram Key. Now, this event sparked several rebellions which were harshly put down, and afterwards 300 Protestants were burned at the stake because of their beliefs, and under her successor, Queen Elizabeth I, England grew into a strong and very Protestant nation. King James was reared during this bloody time in English history. He was born on June 19, 1566. He was the only child of Mary, Queen of Scots. James was only 15 months old when he succeeded his Catholic mother to the Scottish throne. But he did not begin his personal rule of Scotland until 1583. He was a bright young king. James was intellectually reared by one of the greatest Latin scholars of his age, the late Renaissance poet and leading humanist George Buchanan. It was under Buchanan's tutelage that James successfully asserted his position as head of the church and state in Scotland, outwitting all of the nobles who conspired against him. Being eager to succeed the childless Elizabeth I to the English throne, Knight and Lomas chronicled that James merely made a mild protest when his mother was executed for treason against Elizabeth in 1587. The authors continued to recant King James' evolution into dual royalty and Freemason positions, and they did it in this way. At the age of 37, 2 years after becoming a Freemason, James became the first Stuart King of England, and he devoted himself largely to English affairs thereafter. Although raised as a Presbyterian, he immediately antagonized the rising Puritan movement by rejecting a petition for reform of the Church of England at the Hampton Court Conference in 1604. Roman Catholic hostility to a Protestant monarch was widespread, and in 1605 a Catholic plot led by Guy Fawkes failed in an attempt to blow up both the king and Parliament. Despite this assassination plot, there was suspicion in England that James was secretly rather pro-Catholic because he had concluded peace with Spain in 1604. Well, that makes sense. James was apparently a highly intelligent political mover and shaker. Anyone who could disregard his own mother's execution for royal advancement would not likely feign a mutually beneficial proposal from the Catholic Church. This was evidenced by his alliance with Spain. Now, that knowledge placed a new light on the alleged and perceived division between the English and Catholic churches. So I wonder then if this is part of the buried knowledge and great deception of the masses. His thoughts raced with new possibilities. Well, much like today, the shadow governors expertly devise ways to divide the sheeple in order to conquer the flock. They separate rich from poor, black from white, Jew from Gentile, Christian from Muslim, liberal from conservative. And all the while, the oligarchy that controls the military-industrial complex makes its money manipulating people with fear, directing them into bloody conflicts, and thus reducing, when desired, unwanted populations. Just like the James Bond story, the British and Americans suspect the Russians, while the Russians suspect the Americans. Meanwhile, Spectre is really the lethal instigators. Spectre? What does that word mean? Well, Knight and Lomas continued their historic analysis of King James' biblical scholarship. James was a speculative Mason and also wrote books about kingship, theology, witchcraft, and even wrote a book on tobacco. Significantly, James also commissioned a new authorized version of the Bible, which is called after him. It's known as the King James Bible. It is the version that omits the two anti-Nestorian books of Maccabees. The introduction that still appears in the front of this Protestant Bible reveals no Catholic sympathies. And one section reads, "So that if on the one side he shall be traduced by popish persons at home or abroad, who therefore will malign us because we are poor instruments to make God's holy truth to be yet more and more known unto the people, whom they desire still to keep in ignorance and darkness." It should be pointed out that the King James Bible is not copyrighted, and that every one of these New Age versions of the Bible is copyrighted, and those publishing companies make their royalties off of these new King James Bibles. That is, the new King James. It's called NKJV. Now, the old King James is not copyrighted. The Hiram Key authors, much like other modern Masonic testimonials, added that modern Freemasonry is non-sectarian, and it boasts that it always has been so, not because of this alleged period of anti-Catholicism. Knight and Lomas reported that the circumstances of the early 17th century provided the perfect condition for the secret society of Masons to emerge into the public arena. They then went on to explain King James' leadership in the burgeoning Masonic movement. Now, I should point out that Queen Elizabeth belongs to the Masonic order, as does her husband, does all of the royalty of England, and they have for generations past. So the Masonic order is a part and parcel with this thing of the secret societies. It's one of the secret societies, but it is the religion of the secret societies. So if you wanted to know what Bill Clinton's religion is, he's a Mason. You want to know what Barack Obama's allegiance is to? It's the Masonic order. All of these men are Masons. They belong to the Masonic order. They have for generations past, and probably will continue to do so for generations into the future, or until the second coming, whichever comes first. Now, with the king, a speculative white-collar Mason himself, and the power of the Pope blocked for all time in Scotland, the need for total secrecy was suddenly gone. Now, King James was a thinker and a reformer, and he must have felt that the structure of the growing Masonic movement needed to be formalized. So 15 years after he had taken active control of his Scottish kingdom, 2 years before being accepted as a Freemason, and 5 years before becoming the English monarch, King James ordered that the existing Masonic structure be given leadership and organization. It was King James who made a leading Mason by the name of William Shaw, his general warden of the craft, and instructed him to improve the entire structure of Masonry. Shaw started his major project on the 28th of December 1598, when he issued the statutes and ordinances to be observed by all of the master Masons within this realm, signing himself as the general warden of the said craft. Well, 2 years after Shaw's work began, King James appointed himself Grand Master of the Shaw Lodges of Freemasons. Thereafter, the previously secret lodges of Scotland began listing the names of their members and keeping minutes of their meetings. They still did not broadcast their existence, but we can easily identify them today. The geographical location of the first registered lodges show how the rituals cemented at Roslyn by William Shaw became a major movement during the reign of James VI. It was the regulation of both operative and speculative Masonry by William Shaw, Knight and Lomas concluded, that formalized the ritual into what we now know as the 3 degrees of craft Freemasonry, or the Blue Lodge. A speculative Mason was distinguished from an operative Mason by the title Freemason. And from this point onwards, Freemasonry had a lodge structure which would soon spread to England and eventually the entire Western world. This is where the term Freeman or Free Englishman is derived. Interestingly, how this knowledge of power of the threes, sixes, and nines, 3 times 3, and a song of degrees might have translated into the Masonic hierarchy. The 33rd level of Freemasonry is the most famous degree. The 33rd degree. We also use it as a term in investigating crime. When we put somebody on the third degree, we give him the third degree. Now, the birth of modern science occurred around 1600. It was when King James VI of Scotland in 1603 acquired his English kingdom. One of his first acts was to confer knighthood on Francis Bacon, one of the king's favorite intellectuals, as well as brother Freemason. Bacon was then rapidly promoted from Solicitor General to the Crown to Attorney General, to the Lord Keeper of the Great Seal, and finally to the position of Lord Chancellor in 1618. Considered among history's leading philosophers, Brother Bacon sought to rid the human mind of idols, that is, tendencies to error. He planned the Magna, or Great Restoration, in an effort to restore human mastery over nature, and he contained the following six parts, as detailed in the Hiram Key. They are the classification of sciences, a new inductive logic, a gathering of empirical or experimental facts, examples to show the efficacy of this new approach, generalizations derivable from natural history, and a new philosophy that would be complete with science and nature. It was Bacon's work expressed an inductive philosophy of nature, over which man, not God, demonstrated control. Now, a century later, Voltaire and Diderot, the famous French philosophers, describe Bacon as the father of modern science. Sir Francis Bacon, in fact, intermingled his mystical Masonic knowledge with his political aspirations in his book, The New Atlantis. In that book, he advanced his intention to rebuild King Solomon's temple in the spiritual sense. The purpose of this work was to develop a temple of science and great palace of invention. His vision included a new state in which the pursuit of knowledge was organized much like science is today. From this early intellectual seed, modern science as well as the United States Constitution were later germinated. It should be pointed out that the American Revolution was a Masonic revolution of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence. 50 of those 56 signers were members of the Freemasons. Now, when given this background, it is understandable that James would have selected Bacon above anyone else to coordinate the authorized King James Bible, the writing project. So let's pause here and let's think about this for a moment. The King James Bible is the product of the Freemasons. King James was a Freemason, and he turned it over to Sir Francis Bacon, who was the Lord Chancellor and a Freemason. Now, like much of what goes on in the world today, it is orchestrated by these secret societies, and the Masons are not the only secret society. There are many others, as we'll see as we progress along. But I think that this understanding of who has the power to write the Bible was written by the secret societies. Now a question arises, was the secret society of Freemasons, did they translate it faithfully, or did they put some errors in it? Did they do that intentionally? And where did God fit into all of this? I mean, here's the creator of the universe. And he wants to write a book, and he wants to give this book to humanity. Well, that's what we presume, where that's our theory. Does he have anything to do with this? Does he come along and does he inspire any of these people to do this? Well, in the scripture, he says that he inspired the scriptures. He's the guy that did that. 26 writers wrote it down. 26 secretaries wrote down what it was that he told them, inspired them to write. Now, in putting all of this together, do we have the whole Bible? Do the 66 books of the King James Bible represent the whole thing? Well, Ivan Panin said yes and wrote a treatise on the 66 books of the Scripture. We'll take a look at that in the future. There's a number of other internal evidences in the Scripture that indicate that the Scripture is written by somebody who's smarter than the average Joe Sixpack, even smarter than Francis Bacon and King James himself. So as we progress along, what we need to find in our conclusion is that either the King James Version is true, accurate, and correct, or is it some one of these New Age Bible versions that's true, accurate, and correct? Or could it be that all of the above have some errors in it that we should be aware of? So let me point out something to you about deception. In the Bible itself, in the Scripture, the number one problem that is described by the Creator, the author, whoever it was that wrote the Scripture, he said, deception is your number one problem, and he told you that in Matthew 24, verses 4 and 5. Let me just flip over to it quickly and I'll read it to you. Matthew 24, verses 4 and 5. He says, your number one problem is going to be deception. So here's what he said. This is 24. Oh, wait a minute. What verse here? We have Matthew 20. Here it is, the problem. Matthew 24, verses 4 and 5, and Revelation 12, 9. Find Matthew 24. I've got Matthew 4 here. There we are, Matthew 24. Then Jesus answered, and he said to them, "You take heed that no man deceive you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many." So he pointed it out pretty poignantly. He said, these people are going to come to you, and they're going to tell you that I'm Christ. Some of them will probably even tell you that they're Christ, but they're going to tell you that I am Christ, and they're going to deceive you. Well, doesn't that just about encompass most of Christianity? Aren't all these preachers out here telling you about Jesus and him crucified? And come down the Sawdust Trail, give your heart to Jesus today, and be baptized, and join it. And then you can go out and eat pig, and it'll be legal. In Matthew 24, verse 24, he pointed out one other little factoid that comes into play here. He said, "For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and they shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect." So there's a group of people in the Scripture here called the elect, people that are pretty savvy people, pretty knowledgeable about the Scripture. These are people that have actually read the Bible, you know, cover to cover, a time or two, the elect. These aren't casual Christians, you know, that go to church once a year, twice a year, you know, on Christmas and Easter, and that have never read the Scripture, don't know what it says. These people have read the Scripture, and they're very knowledgeable as to what the Scripture says. And he said, even the very elect are going to be subject to deception. And that's pretty powerful deception. If the very elect who know the Scripture are close to being deceived, well, where is that going to leave the average Joe six-pack who couldn't even recite the first four books of the New Testament or called the Gospels or the first five books of the Old Testament called the Pentateuch? Huh? Now, in Revelation 12, verse 9, there's a little story over here about Lucifer, Satan. And it says that this guy deceives the whole world. Revelation 12, verse 9 says, "That great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." Jesus said that he beheld Satan as lightning cast down to the earth. He said he saw him fall from heaven. Now, that's quite a little statement. Satan fell from the government of God. He's on planet Earth. He's described in the Scripture as being a literal person, even though the New Age guys will tell you, no, he's really not a real person. He's just a thought. He's just a principle. No one to really get too concerned about. Scripture has something else to say, and that's one of the deceptions that's pointed out here in this New Age Bible version. Now, here's the dilemma that we find ourselves in trying to decipher whether or not the King James is true, accurate, and correct, or mostly so, or partly so, or it's just another lying deception like the rest of these versions of the Scripture. And if that's the case, well, then where is the true Scripture? Where would we find that document? Or is there any such document as the true Scripture? Well, hang on, let me give you a reminder here that we're at the halfway point of the program, and you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's eight schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there, georgegordon.org. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're looking at a book here called The New Age Versions of the Bible, and actually we're going to review three books all at the same time. Three books. So I raised in the first half of today's program this startling new specter, and that is that the King James Bible was written by Freemasons. It's these Freemasons who are the same people who are members of the secret societies who are rewriting the King James Version and giving us these New Age Versions of the Bible. So what makes us believe then, or what makes us think that the King James is perfect or close to it? And how much has the old King James been perverted? And how much of the old King James has been perverted by these new versions? And how can we come to a knowledge of the truth? How are we going to follow our Messiah's instruction to watch out, be careful, that you don't become deceived? Now here in Matthew 24, he starts off the chapter, Matthew 24, about verse 4 and 5. Jesus answered and said to them, "You take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and they shall deceive many." In verse 24, he adds to that by saying, "For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders," miracles. I mean, these guys are going to call fire down from heaven and burn up their adversary in your vision, in your view, right in front of your eyeballs. Now, isn't that going to demonstrate the power of God right in front of you? And he says right here, he said, you know, this is going to be such powerful medicine that it will tent, if it were possible. He said, the very elect would be deceived. So before we took our break, I pointed out that the elect are these people that actually read the scripture. I mean, you know, a guy that's read the whole book of Matthew and is familiar with these predictions and these prophecies. You know, for instance, there's a thing coming here in the future called the mark of the beast. And we won't be able to buy, sell, or trade without that mark. If you don't have the mark, you can't buy, sell, or trade. And God tells you if you have the mark, he's going to kill you. Hey, you talk about being caught between a rock and a hard spot. Now, this writing of the King James version of the Bible was given to Francis Bacon, a Freemason, by King James, who was a Freemason, and the New Age Bible versions today are being rewritten by the Freemasons again. So I ask the question, well, who can you trust? Well, there's an answer to this riddle, but this thing of deception is spoken of in the Scripture often and over. For instance, in Matthew 7, verse 15, the Messiah makes an observation, and he says, hey, listen, there's some false prophets that have gone out into the world. Not everybody that you listen to. And oftentimes I'm called a false prophet. I don't know how many times I get emails and letters and telephone calls. You lying hypocrite, you false prophet. I deny that I'm a false prophet. I deny that I'm a prophet. First, before you could become a false prophet, you'd have to be a prophet. And then you would have to take the prophecy and you'd have to turn it on its head to become a false prophet. Now, there are people who are prophets. I'm just not one of them. I'm a commentator. I'm a reviewer. I'm an investigative reporter, but I'm not a prophet. Now, it may well be that my report is false. It's been pointed out to me more than once that we have taken information and put it on the air, and then it was proven to be incorrect. That happens. And when it happens, we try to correct that, and we say, well, we made a mistake. Let's correct this. Now, a false prophet in Matthew 7:15, listen to this. Here's the Messiah saying, you need to watch out for guys like this. Beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. Now, you'll know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Well, even so, every good tree brings forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree brings forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, and neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that brings not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. Wherefore, by their fruits you shall know them. So, you need to measure what I'm telling you by my fruits. Well, let's see if we can do this. In the New Age version of the book, written by G.A. Ripplinger, let me give you the G.A. Ripplinger, and then you can probably get a copy of this from any Bible bookstore, would be my guess. It's called New Age Bible Versions, copyright by G.A. Ripplinger, 1993, published by A.V. Publications Corporation, Post Office Box 280, Ararat, A-R-A-R-A-T, Virginia, 24053. Let me give you that again. That's published by A.V. Publications, Post Office Box 280, Ararat, A-R-A-R-A-T, Virginia, 24053. Now, the author compares all of these New Age versions to the King James. I'm simply raising the question, well, is the King James really the standard by which we should compare these two, or could it be that the King James has got some errors also? So I'm going to raise that issue, then we're going to answer that as we progress along. The answer, for your information up front, is, yeah, the King James version is pretty accurate. There's 172 major mistranslations in the King James, which have all been identified. The King James translators made some clear mistakes. For instance, the name Jesus is a false name. That's the name of the Greek god Zeus. The Messiah is the correct term. Christ. Christ is Krishna. That's the Indian sun god. That's obviously not the name of the Messiah. So we should be using the word Messiah, or anointed one, would be a more, you know, a more reasonable translation. But again, even if we presume that the name Jesus and Christ are the correct names, which most Christians do, then there's a false Christ spoken of in the Scripture, an anti-Christ spoken of in the Scripture, an anti-Messiah, a false Messiah. Well, how does that guy figure into the mix here? And what do these New Age versions have to do with this mix? And then how are you and I going to identify this false, this fraud? Is there a modality by which we could identify these lies? And the answer is, yeah. It's called the Kwok Ting test. Kwok Ting. Write that down. Q-U-O-C-K. Q-U-O-C-K. Kwok Ting. T-I-N-G. It's cited in the U.S. Supreme Court reports at 140 U.S. 417. That's volume 140 of the U.S. Supreme Court reports on page 417, written in 1891. It's called the Kwok Ting test. It's the test that we apply to determine whether somebody's telling the truth. It's kind of simple and straightforward. Every judge in the country uses it. Every lawyer who's come out of law school knows the Kwok Ting test. Now, it's not something for lay people to know, because if everybody knew what this test was, then everybody would know how to feign telling the truth. So when you have a liar like Bill Clinton and Hillary who know the Kwok Ting test, that's what makes the liar 10 times more effective. The false prophet, the deceiver, he's more effective because he knows how to deceive you into believing the lie. That's why the very elect could potentially be deceived. And as we'll see here in the New Age Bible versions, many of these translators have been deceived into believing and quoting those occult scriptures from the ancient Babylonian mystery religion, and they have actually quoted those and put them right into their new versions of the Bible. Sometimes they do it intentionally because they're occult themselves, but sometimes they're simply deceived into doing it, and they didn't know that they did it. That's what deception is all about. A deception has to be a counterfeit that is so good that it looks as good as or better than the original. When a liar comes to you, he's never going to tell you that he's a liar. The deceiver comes to you and says, oh, you can believe me because I'm telling you the truth, even though the Scripture says, let God be true, though every man be found a liar. So maybe one of the first steps would be to admit, first of all, that we're liars. And so when somebody comes into class here, for instance, I will ask them, are you a liar? And they look at me kind of strangely, like, huh? And they don't want to admit it. So I always ask them this question. I say, well, have you ever told a lie in the past? Any time in the past, have you ever fudged a little bit and just told a little white lie, you know? And everybody will say, well, yeah, at some point in the time in the past, I probably told a little white lie. And then I say, well, do you think that maybe before you die, sometime in the future, you might tell one more lie? Most people will say, well, yeah, probably before I die, I'll probably tell one more little white lie. And then I ask the closer, I say, have you lied recently, you know, within the last month or two or week or 10 days or yesterday or today? Or have you fudged a little bit and told something that wasn't quite true, accurate, and correct? Well, maybe I've done that. Maybe I have told a little white lie recently, you know, within the last month or two. I can't remember what it is, they'll always say, but maybe I did. Well, then, aren't you then admitting to being a liar past, present, and future? And isn't that the point that the Scripture is making when it says, let God be true, though every man be found a liar? And is this lying pathological, or is it done intentionally? That is, pathological would be, well, yeah, I lie and I can't help myself. And the Apostle Paul made an observation. He said, oh, what a wretched man I am. He said, that I would do, I don't, and that I wouldn't do, I do. I find myself lying when I ought to be telling the truth. And as they say down here in the Ozarks, why, that guy would sooner lie when the truth would serve his purpose better. Or as one old guy told me one day, he said, that guy'd rather climb a tree in the middle of the night to tell a lie than stand on the ground flat-footed and tell the truth. Putting it another way, the guy goes out of his way to lie when telling the truth would serve his purpose better. Now, sometimes people lie and they don't know that they're lying. These are called constructive frauds. Sometimes people lie and they know they're lying, and that's called an actual fraud. So let's learn a little something here about deception. A deceiver must tell the truth at least some of the time to deceive you, because if I always lied to you, then you would always know the truth. And that's because I'm always lying. Now, if I always told you the truth, you would always know the truth, because I'm always telling you the truth, and the truth is always true. To deceive you, I have to tell you the truth and mix it with a lie to create a deception. And isn't that what false prophets are doing? Aren't they deceiving us? Now, whether it's over the Twin Towers, or whether it's over this oil spill in the Gulf, or it's over the weapons of mass destruction that we went to war in Iraq over, or if it's the Al-Qaeda threat that we're fighting in Afghanistan over, don't we have to have truth mixed with error here? So here's the way this works. Truth plus truth equals truth, and error plus error equals error. Deception is a combination of the two. Deception is truth mixed with error. So the president doesn't always lie to us. BP isn't always lying to us. They're telling us the truth about some of what's going on, and then they mix that with error. And then that keeps us deceived, which is the purpose behind these secret societies. It is to deceive the masses, the useless eaters. And then the adepts, those that are selected to know these secrets, they are given these secrets. How's that for a plan? Well, now, given this background, it's understandable that King James would have selected Francis Bacon above everyone to coordinate the authorized King James writing project over the Bible. Which brings us now up to the Knights Templar's power. To understand why King James authorized a Bible, which, as you will increasingly learn, encoded Masonic secrets, requires further discussion, particularly the persecution of the Templars by the Roman Catholic Church and its leaders should also be entertained. So what is believed to have been the central source of discord between the two groups is the great power and wealth that the esoteric knowledge provided those who possesses the Arcana. And according to many authors, the Templars were said to have discovered many of the ancient scrolls and much of the Zion booty that the Romans had originally lifted from King Solomon's temple in the Holy Land in 70 AD. Some say the Freemasons found the treasures themselves in Solomon's temple while they were guarding the Holy Land at a later date. Researchers also speculate that this ancient treasure of knowledge and wealth repeatedly changed hands through the centuries, passing perhaps from the Temple of Jerusalem to the Romans, to the Visigoths, and eventually to the Cathars, who were persecuted and then mass murdered in France, and or the Knights Templar. Well, according to Lawrence Gardner, the appointed historian and sovereign genealogist to 33 royal families, and Britain's grand prior of the sacred kindred of St. Columba, the royal ecclesiastical seat of the Celtic Church, who had access to Celtic Church records dating back to 37 AD, and Templar documents removed from Europe in 1128, the Templars became a specific target of inquisition in 1307. When the armies of Pope Clement V and King Philip IV of France were sent in their direction. Not only had the knights returned from the Holy Land with important first century documentation, but they had also returned with incredible wealth and treasure, and they were not only in a position to dismantle the church structure with their knowledge of the royal bloodline genealogy, but the Templar order was financially far richer than the Vatican itself, and therefore posed a significant threat. In fact, the Templars at that stage were the richest single order that the world has ever known. And the whole of our international banking network today, that we all use today in our clearinghouses, was all established by the Knights Templar in that era when they funded every European court. Gardner continued during a speech at Yale University in 1994. He said, the papal armies scoured Europe for the Templar documents and the treasure, but like the other Cathar inheritance, nothing was found. Many knights were tortured, executed in the process, and their companions were banished to two regions outside the papal domain. But the Templar hoard, although not found, was never lost. Its day-to-day existence is recorded, and all the time that they're searching for it in southern France, it was locked away in the treasury vaults of Paris. One night it was loaded onto 18 galleys at the port of La Rochelle, and the fleet set sail for Scotland. There, the Templars were welcomed by King Robert the Bruce, along with the whole Scottish nation, the Templars and their treasure from the moment in time. Apart from an offshoot order in Portugal, remained in Scotland. The Templar treasure today remains in Scotland. Additional background on this important historic period was written by Bagent, Lay, and Lincoln in their work called The Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And at dawn on Friday the 13th, 1307, King Philip IV of France and Pope Clement V, who Philip IV had installed by conspiring with his ministers to kill Pope Boniface VIII and Pope Benedict IX, they rounded up all of the knights, including their Grand Master, Jacques de Molay, and the Pope wanted their empowering scrolls, the King, their great wealth. Well, the scrolls again contained the Arcana, A-R-C-N-A. I'm going to underline that word because that Arcana is the power that the witches and warlocks, these occult forces use. And that's what that word is describing, as occult power. Well, the mysterious knowledge that only Templar initiates were taught, and it also contained the spiritually important numbers that were believed to facilitate God's magic. I'm going to underline God's magic over here. That's pretty important, too. Because this magic now comes from sorcery, comes from witchcraft, which is prohibited in the scripture. So what we're dealing with here is two gods. We've got a god by the name of Lucifer and a god by the name of Elohim, or the Creator, or Yahweh, or Allah, or, you know, whoever it is you think is the true God. And then there's this snake in the woodpile over here called Lucifer, known also as Satan or the devil. And the scripture tells us a little something about this guy, Satan. He's the prince of the power of the air. He actually offered the world and all of its kingdoms to the Messiah. And we'll see that in Matthew chapter 4, isn't it? I think it's Matthew 4. Let me read that to you. There was a time when the Messiah was tempted by Lucifer. Then was Jesus led up of the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, he was afterward hungered. And when the tempter came to him, he said, "If you be the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread." And the Messiah answered and said, "It is written, man shall live by not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." And then the devil took him up into the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple. And he said to him, "If you be the Son of God, cast yourself down, because it is written, he shall give his angels charge concerning you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest at any time you should dash your foot against a stone." And Jesus said to him, he said, "Well, it's written again, you shall not tempt the Lord your God." So again the devil took him up into the exceeding high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them. And he said to him, "All these things will I give you, if you fall down and worship me." Then said Jesus unto him, "Get you hence, Satan, because it is written, you shall worship the Eternal, your God, and him only shall you serve." So then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and ministered unto him. So right there we see that Satan is the king of this world. Isn't that real strange or real special? Yeah, I'm running short on time. I got to give you a final reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. Hey, we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.